Does anyone have any thoughts or reflections about sort of the visit, worship, learn, if you had a chance to sort of reflect on how that might either change or inspire or whatnot, inform the way you relate with nature?
My only thought, and I've mentioned before, is the role of everything that's newer than that, but the role of human greed when you talk about living together, how it always gets in the way. And I don't know if that's philosophy.
Yeah, absolutely. There's definitely aspects of rights and responsibilities and how do we distribute things, where does our own personal greed and or need come into play, and how should it be excluded? One thing that I experienced with the kind of the prompts that you provided in particular was the idea of worship. The visit and learning, I think I can apply in this different way, but the worship thing was the one that stood out to me the most in terms of the preservation idea. So when we think about worshiping something, or there is this element of the protection and that it's sort of on this altar in some way. And I'm wondering a little bit, like, seen, and maybe that would contribute to that being this, doesn't have to, but it could contribute to it being that separate thing as something that's really amazing and pure and beautiful about it. Does anyone else have an experience with the worship thing in particular, or thoughts about that?
Well, what made me think about it was the, like, for example, the works of Machu Picchu, which is a water system that's completely sustainable. It's still, but that culture had a worship of nature that they put to their benefit. They learned from it and worked with it. So they worshiped the river, they worshiped the mountain as their gods. That was a big part of their mindset. And I don't think that when we worship nature, we go to that level of making it a deity. And so we still don't honor it. I mean, how can you trash the environment when it's your God, for example? I know that's kind of rambling, but
no,
do we worship? You know, if that's what we call it, do we set it aside as a wilderness? But we don't really honor it in other ways, honor the thought of the natural world.
Yeah, no, and that might actually be a perfect transition into this idea of conservation and sort of Pinchot's work a little bit as well. Like, how do we honor nature? Is it something that we work with?
If you don't mind, I'd like to sort of stay with these discussions little while longer. Because, I think my reaction to that is to think about John Muir in his life when he was a child and his dad's notion of worship involved... I mean, his dad literally believed that the only way to get into heaven, the only way to be rewarded in the afterlife, was to live your life full of unrewarded toil. And so he would tell John, dig a well here, and John would dig, and he would come across a big rock. And it's like, well, couldn't we just move it over there where there's no rock? No. You need to dig through the rock because your reward is the toil itself.
Huh.
And so to be raised in that sense of worshiping this other that is so foreign and so difficult, for John to try to start shifting more into nature, I wonder whether that's what he was sort of about.
Huh.
So, and I wonder, in addition to worship, did people have other thoughts about the visit and learn aspect of the reflection? Yeah.
Well, those words make me realize that what it means to visit a place is to come to it from outside, not to live in it and be a part of it, as, for example, native people are.
Right.
In the environment.
Right. Well said. Thank you.
So it's really a white man's perspective on nature.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Interesting. I know for me, the learning, as I looked at a lot of these downed logs, you know, the from a resource perspective, it's like, why aren't we using those for timber? And yet from an ecological perspective, when we leave nature alone, we can learn how the ecosystem works. Ecology was not very advanced in Muir's time, but I think he had an instinct toward observing natural systems, natural processes, and perhaps being able to model our human lives on what has worked in natural systems for so long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. Did you take John Muir's dad toiling his life away in the Lord's word heaven? When did he have 5 minutes to sit down and think about anything beyond what work had to be done for the day? I mean, he that's the whole idea of philosophy. Isn't it great that we are so privileged that we can think about these things instead of having to work our butts off all day to get whatever had to get done?
John Muir was always so joyful through the rest of his life, I think, in part in gratitude for, I get to wander, I get to think, I get to write, I don't have to toil. Yeah.
Well, and the learn part, what resonated with me, like when we study sciences like biomimicry, we learn from nature, but we haven't taken the next step is what is our role to give back to nature. We only learn what we can use, and we're missing as a species, as white people, what is our role in the cycle to give back to nature, and we don't even ask that question anymore. Whereas I think more native cultures had that cyclical view of learning, like what's my give back, not just what's my takeaway.
I think that's another great transition into our alternative way of looking at nature, unless anyone else has some reflections to share. I came to this alternative view, again, through a person not as famous as John Muir. If you haven't heard of Gifford Pinchot, that's okay. Even my literary agent said, Pinochet? And I said, no, there were no Chilean dictators involved in the life of John Muir. Gifford Pinchot is most famous as the founder of the U.S. Forest Service. And if we have any current or former Forest Service employees here, they will definitely know the name of Gifford Pinchot in the same way that if we had some Apple employees, they would know the name of Steve Jobs. Gifford Pinchot, 15 or 20 years younger than John Muir, born 1865, I think. Late 60s, anyways. Born in incredible wealth. His parents lived in New York City, but took the family to Europe for a couple of years when he was young. He went to Phillips Exeter boarding school and then to Yale. He had all sorts of privilege. He ran in a very small, wealthy circle in New York. A few years younger then, but very similar to Theodore Roosevelt. And indeed, when they met in the 1890s, they became close friends. And so it was Roosevelt who appointed Pinchot as the first director of the U.S. Forest Service. And it was Pinchot who influenced Roosevelt's environmental policies, not only in forests, but in terms of setting aside lands for national parks, national monuments, national wildlife refuges. A lot of Roosevelt's reputation today, he's a great character, he did lots of interesting things, but when historians look at what he accomplished, they tend to focus on his environmental accomplishments in terms of those land set-asides and other efforts to protect the environment. And almost all of that came from Pinchot. Pinchot even wrote the section of Roosevelt's autobiography about environmental issues. So Pinchot and Roosevelt were very, very closely intertwined intellectually and also personally. Again, both coming from these wealthy Protestant backgrounds, both very into physical fitness. The first time they met, they had a boxing match and a wrestling match. Pinchot much taller. Pinchot was 6'2", probably, and even skinnier than I am when he was young. He was able to do pretty well in the boxing match, but Roosevelt, who was 30, 40 pounds higher, really won the wrestling match. both very interested in politics. And to me, what really struck me about Pinchot was his desire to be a statesman. It's sort of an old-fashioned word for someone who devotes his or her life to improving the nation, the people as a whole. A politician can seem somewhat greedy and venal, but a statesman is sort of the ultimate version of the selfless politician. And that's what Pinchot wanted to be from a very young age. He wanted to devote his life not to making more money, because his parents had already made, and grandparents had already made, as much money as they could, but by helping people, helping society. And he especially wanted to do it through forestry, in part through a sense of sort of generational guilt. The original source of their income had been when Pinchot's grandfather moved to Milford, Illinois, in the northeast corner of this, Pennsylvania, in the northeast corner of Pennsylvania, and cut down every tree in sight, floated them down the Delaware River to a mill, and then just left the denuded landscapes. Maybe some sucker will buy this and try to plant some more trees. And Pinchot and his father really wanted to atone for that sin against nature. And they jointly decided, when Gifford was a teenager, that he could become America's first forester. There was no science of forestry back then. There were no forestry schools. There was no forestry class, even in an undergraduate school. And so after graduating from Yale, Gifford went over to Europe, where forestry had started to develop, took a bunch of classes, apprenticed with a bunch of expert foresters, and learned this sort of basic sustainable notion that as you cut down this tree here, it might be nice to plant one next to it so that someone in the future will have another tree. If we can cut down only 5 or 10% of the trees every year, we will always have more trees available to be cut down. Now we used the word sustainability, and some of us used it in the previous discussion. And this was sort of, that word wasn't used a lot back then, but these were some of the first inklings towards that notion that, as Pinchot put it, we need to have the greatest good for the greatest number in the long run. And so, not only with trees, but with grasslands and with water, we need to not be just consuming everything so quickly. There was, in the late 1890s, a fear of a timber famine. They thought we would cut down every single tree in the country and not have any trees available to build future houses or fences or et cetera, et cetera. America was consuming trees at 4 or 5 times the rate of Europe, simply because we had always seen that there were more trees and always expected, well, we'll have more to cut down. But after they mowed through the trees of the upper Midwest so quickly and started in on the forests of the Pacific Northwest in the 1880s and 90s, some people were saying, this might be a problem. I mean, it'll be an economic problem. We won't have an economy if we don't have trees to fuel that economy. We need to do some long-range planning. And so Pinchot was not the first, but among the most politically effective of those people suggesting an alternate route. When he returned from Europe, he first tried working for private landowners. Property rights is real big. Let's make sure that if we want to conserve a forest, let's have somebody buy it and conserve it. One of his mentors in Europe said, well, why don't you just get your grandfather to give you $500,000 to buy some land? This was actually his maternal grandfather, who was also incredibly wealthy. And he said, the grandfather said, I'd be happy to give you $500,000, but you have to go into business. I don't understand all this forestry stuff. And so Gifford went, oh, no, that won't work. I'll try working for other people. But the scale just wasn't big enough. The size of a landscape that you want to conserve, even the Vanderbilts, one of the richest families in the country, they were buying a lot of property down in near Asheville, North Carolina, the Biltmore Mansion now is still quite famous there. They bought just huge tracts of forests and hired Pinchot to manage those forests. And he did the best he could, but he realized he needed to work at an even bigger scale, and that's when he started working with government. Actually got into the government before Roosevelt did, the federal government. So he was a forester. He was a genius manager. The reason that people in the Forest Service remember him was that he was just incredibly efficient and incredibly inspiring. And if any of you are in sort of business management, you would just admire the hell out of him. He was able to balance all of his priorities and tasks. He was able to lobby Congress for more money and yet supervise employees and yet run his budgets and answer all of his correspondence before 10 a.m. the next day. He was a political advisor to Roosevelt, later served two terms as governor of Pennsylvania himself. He probably had greater ambitions. He probably would have liked to succeed Roosevelt as president. That didn't quite come to pass for him. He later wrote a few books, but nothing as inspiring or fun as Muir's books. But he was certainly a multi-talented person. He was really good at public relations. Roosevelt is famous for the bully pulpit, where instead of trying to convince Congress people, he would just convince the common people that his way was correct, and then they would influence Congress. And Pinchot and Roosevelt worked together on that bully pulpit, especially on environmental issues. So that's sort of the quick summary of Gifford Pinchot. While Muir was staying here in Helena in a hotel, Pinchot had actually come out to Montana about 6 weeks previously, had gone up to the Blackfeet Reservation and hired a guide to take him hunting, and just loved that country. Of course, back then, the Blackfeet Reservation included the eastern half of what is now Glacier National Park. So they were able to hike up into some of those glaciers, say in the Mini Glacier area. And then he and one of his guides crossed over the Continental Divide into about Big Fork and decided to hike the Sealy Swan. And if you can imagine the Sealy Swan before the highway was there, it must have been this just wonderfully wild place, not too high in elevation, but plenty of thick forests and beautiful lakes. And they just sort of wandered through. They apparently were having so much fun that they forgot what day it was. And they needed to meet John Muir and the other folks up at a train station. And so suddenly they realized that was like a day or two from now. And so they hiked 52 miles in 26 hours, most of it with no trail, in order to get to the nearest railroad station so that they could get up to Belton, Montana in time. So he was also sort of a tough outdoorsman, capable of wandering. That was the other reflection I had as we were walking, and people kept having to tell Marisa which way, which trail we should take. That wanderer.
Hi. Yep.
John Muir. So as with Muir, it was sort of after Pinchot's time at the Forest Service. He actually got fired by Roosevelt's successor at a fairly young age. Pinchot was still in his 40s, and that's when he became governor, etc. But the people who then took over his environmental legacy saw this as a philosophy of conservation. We conserve some of our resources to use tomorrow. Conservation, the word, had been in existence for quite some time. Pinchot was sort of egotistical. He at one point said that he had invented conservation, and everyone laughed. And conservation today is often used similar to preservation, someone who cares about nature and doesn't want it ruthlessly exploited. But in philosophical terms, when we think about conservation, we're thinking about saving some of these resources for the future, being able to use our natural resources for today and tomorrow. Pinchot's favorite quote, "the greatest good for the greatest number in the long run," actually had some philosophical basis.
Very utilitarian.
Utilitarians said greatest good for the greatest number. He bragged that he added in the long run. But can you talk a little bit about utilitarianism?
Ooh, we're actually going to be doing a philosophy drive-in on utilitarianism at some point in the near future. The most simple form of it is this idea, the greatest good for the greatest number. There is, in some sense, in the long run, that's implied, but not quite in the way that he did it. It was supposed to be a way to make decisions. You're constantly having to move through the world and make all sorts of decisions, and how can we scale our decisions in a way that will help us flourish. So utilitarianism sort of had as its end the carrot at the end of the stick, this idea, what action can I take that will contribute to the good, for sort of the common good or the good for all. It doesn't necessarily always play out that way, and some of the challenges with utilitarianism that deontology, Kant and company would put forward is what happens to the sort of individual rights aspects, because there's definitely... it can play out where an individual, it might be the good for everyone, but at the risk of, well, you guys are going to have to take the fall for it.
Wearing a mask.
So it's not without its challenges. And it's certainly utilitarianism and deontology, some of those elements are very present in our current way of moving through politics in the world. There are some of our most predominant ways of making decisions. One thing I wanted to ask, with this idea of conservation and resources, nature being a resource or a plethora of resources, did Pinchot allow any room for a spiritual, in whatever form that might mean, a spiritual relationship with nature as well in his approach? Because you mentioned something about the sin, atoning for the sins of, so it seems like it's there. So I'm just curious if you can say a little more.
And again, I think that question puts its finger on one of our big points for the day, is I think Pinchot's successors tended to view conservation in this very technical, professional way of, well, let's measure the resources and let's consider the impacts and let's look into the future. And I think Pinchot himself was deeper than that. Pinchot is often revered for his technical competence at answering all of his mail before 10 a.m. the next day. and people see him as this sort of a stiff, rich, taskmaster kind of guy, morally appropriate but firm. And so I really enjoyed learning the story about his fiance. Pinchot was not married through his whole time as as the leader of the Forest Service, and so he was almost sort of this aesthetic priest-like character. But it turns out that he had been engaged to be married in his mid to late twenties. Another wealthy woman, very similar in social class to him, really well matched, apparently very beautiful and intelligent, but she suffered from tuberculosis. The reason they met was that she had gone to Asheville, North Carolina, in hopes that the elevation would help her lungs. There was no cure for TB at the time. And sure enough, after they'd known each other for about a year, year and a half, she died. And yet, for the next 20 years, Pinchot always believed that she was close to him, that she was speaking to him, that she was guiding him through all of these difficult speeches or all the negotiations that he would have to do. In his diary, every day he would record a clear day, cloudy day, or some variation of that. And he wasn't talking about the weather. He was talking about his connection, his spiritual connection to his fiancée in the afterworld. So he was a very spiritual man who was sort of constricted by the social milieu of his time, and especially of of the wealthy New York circle that he ran in. He loved seances because that was a chance to perhaps communicate more effectively with his fiance. And yet in his circle, seances were a little bit strange, anti-intellectual for sure. So he had a hunger for spirituality. And when you read his letters with John Muir, you see you see him wanting to learn from Muir about those spiritual aspects of nature. There was one case when Pinchot and Muir were together on the Grand Canyon, and they were supposed to be doing some stuff with some other people, but Muir said, "Hey, let's just run off and look at the stars over the canyon." And Pinchot said, "Yeah." And that was one of the most interesting parts of his very long and self-serving autobiography, was his description of this episode with Muir where he got to touch those spiritual aspects of nature. So we've had a lot of, I heard a lot of support in the earlier discussion for notions of sustainability, notions of conservation, the way Pinchot sees, because this whole notion of conservation means that we are part of nature. We are going to be using these trees. We cannot exist without using wood or plants or animals to raise on plants, etc. And so as we are part of nature, maybe conservation makes more sense. But I think as Marisa was highlighting the difficulties of the utilitarian perspective that conservation is based on, one of the big questions is, who decides? Who decides what is the greatest good? Who decides whether the greatest number really is getting the greatest good out of this particular move or not? For Pinchot and Roosevelt, it was obvious. Well, they were wealthy and educated and smart and selfless and devoted to the people, so they should get to decide. Maybe it worked okay in their case. It hasn't worked so well since then. So that was one of the issues I saw. Is there any way from
to balance this sort of holistic approach and the resource-based approach?
Is there any way to make that resource-based approach more democratic?
That's a great question.
to me, that's one of the problems that we're facing right now, is that the scientists are telling us to wear masks, and we're like, yeah, sure, you guys are educated and smart and advantaged, and you must know better. And there are some people who are saying, why do you get to decide? Mm-hmm. Isn't this a democracy? Don't I have the right to make bad decisions? And the rest of us are saying, no, not when those bad decisions affect us too. But I think that's a real tension in this conservation philosophy.
You know, one problem I've always had with not Pinchot's approach necessarily, but the approach of the Forest Service after his day, was treating forestry almost like agriculture. You know, thinking of these trees as a crop, and thinking in terms of management for maximum production and harvesting as a harvest. And that seems to narrow down the potential of these woods quite a bit. You know, that, you know, most crops are, you know, monocultures that can actually sustain. And that approach applied to forestry. I've been in forestry school for a while. And that's why I got out of the profession, because I didn't like that approach. Actually, might define a great number of value of forest products. And the more forest products we can produce, the better. So let's maximize productivity. And a lot of folks still feel that way. But I don't know how you get away from that. You know, the market, you know, approach. You know, if people like us have a demand for some use of these woods other than cutting down the trees and building things, you know, how do we count? And I think, you know, that's happening in quite a few ways now, but we have a ways to go. You know, Well, when you came up here, the first thing you remarked about was, you know, all the fallen trees down there, you know, the beetles got them or whatever it was, but why are we using that wood? And all I could think of when you said that was, well, you know, it's being used by the on the fungi and the rodents and everybody else out there, you know, so it is being used. And we're not using it, but something is, and we should respect that something. But, you know, I didn't really follow up beyond that, but I think that's the problem I have anyway.
I think that's really well said, that especially after Pinchot, forestry became sort of a technician job of how do you get out the biggest cut, because there was an assumption that that would create the greatest good for the greatest number. And rather than a technician, Pinchot had always seen himself as more of a philosopher of the forest, to be able to be out there asking these questions about how do we use nature most effectively? How do we manage nature most effectively?
It also seems maybe in the calculation of the greatest good for the greatest number for Pinchot, maybe something that was potentially left out was the greatest good for the greatest number of also non-human species. I think that's something, and I don't know if that was part of his philosophy, but maybe it was more human-centric in general in terms of the greatest good for the greatest number at the expense of non-human species.
When Pinchot was studying in Europe, he toured German forests, which were then the ultimate in forestry, and he was appalled at how sterile they were. I've never been to Germany, but from all my stereotypes of Germans, I can picture them being in these firm lines and, you know, let's sweep out the forest every night. And Pinchot said, no, he said that won't work in America. I think he was also saying that doesn't really work. That's not the forestry that I have in mind. And so what he was doing at the time, which was incredibly controversial, was saying, yeah, we're not going to cut down all these trees today because we're going to save some for tomorrow. But implied in that for him, and maybe lost by his successors, was, well, yeah, and we're going to manage this forest for a variety of values. We can manage it for the wildlife or for the grass quality or for the spiritual values. But at the time, it was really pretty simple. There was people who wanted to cut trees, and there was people who didn't want to cut trees. And his political task was to manage that fight successfully. In the last 100 years or more, we're using nature in many other ways. We're able to mountain bike or to do philosophy walks, or we're able to, you know, drive our Jeep to a remote trailhead. We have all these new recreational uses. And we also have so much more knowledge about ecology and how animals actually use these resources in competition with the way that humans do. Pinchot, I don't think, would have been opposed to those new alternative uses. He would have said, yeah, our job in conservation is to manage all those uses, to decide where we can prioritize one and deprioritize the other. And again, it's hugely attractive until you ask the question, who decides? And then it gets tricky.
Henry?
So it seems like there's also, and Marisa can correct me on the philosophy, but they're following very different traditions as I see them. One is, Pinchot seems more like John Locke in that it's like, yes, we're managing this, but we're managing it for people. It must be productive for humans. Whereas Muir is more like Rousseau and saying wildness has a value in and of itself.
Yeah.
And so the difference is human-centric versus non-human-centric in a way.
Yeah, I think that's right. Or at least that I think that's correct in terms of...
I don't know anything about Locke and Rousseau. I think that's a nice summary. I would also add that it does seem that Muir is interested in, he's still interested in the benefits to humans. It's just the spiritual benefits to humans. He loved dogs, he loved animals, he believed that they had rights. But in the end, he tended to think about them in terms of their influence on us. And so when today's conservation biologists sort of really push for us to
set nature aside and not necessarily go hiking there, not use it for our recreational or spiritual value. I think that's a step beyond what Muir would have proposed.
Hmm.
One that I frankly have problems with. So if anyone is up on conservation biology, I'd love for y'all to speak up on it.